Well, hi everybody, it's Toby Miller here. Welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. And the podcast today is coming to you from the Nickel Cafe or Diner?
Diner.
Yeah, the Nickel Diner on Main Street in downtown LA. And I'm here with two new friends, if you can be friends with people you've met 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
But who very kindly consented to come into the pod and talk, amongst other things, about their new book, Love Inshallah.
Yeah.
And they, I've got to get these pronunciations correct, because even though Aisha, in your case, I've been saying that name since I was about 8 years old because of the novel She, I'm still trying to work out that I get it right. Aisha. Mm-hmm. So it's not really an A, it's like a Y.
Exactly.
So, Aisha and Noura Maslavi. Have I got that right, Noura?
Noura Maznavi.
Maznavi, my apologies. Thank you very much. So, I've just got the scoop on you guys when you were chatting, waiting to order, that you've both dedicated your lives right now comprehensively to the new book. So, what gives? How did that happen? And what kind of experience is it to do that?
So I am, this is Noura, I'm a civil rights attorney. I've been working about the last 9 years on different issues affecting marginalized communities. I was working for a while doing prisoner rights class actions here in California. And then for the last, most recently I was working for a Muslim civil rights organization working on issues that affect the American Muslim community, so FBI surveillance issues, other sort of religious and racial profiling. But I left my job about 3 weeks ago to focus on this book, which Aisha and I have been working on for almost the last 5 years.
5 years?
Yes, 5 years, and we're about 2 weeks away from publication, and so we thought this is crunch time. We got to give it all right now. So that's why I left my job. I'm very much enjoying working on the book.
And just before we get on to how Aisha left her job, you guys are so old. Working as a civil rights attorney in this particular area, must have been especially awkward in the last decade, I guess. I'm assuming that that's probably the period during which you became an attorney.
Right. It's been a challenge. I mean, I think a lot of the issues facing the American Muslim community affect me personally, and I think that was a real challenge. So professionally, you're working on these issues, but on the weekends, I'd have friends calling me. You know, the FBI just showed up at my door, or I was just detained at the airport for several hours. So personally, it took a real toll. And I see this book as sort of another facet of the work that I was doing, in that it's telling stories of real-life American, everyday Americans that sometimes get lost in the real politicization of Islam and Americans and Muslims in America.
Yeah.
So that's sort of what really intrigued me about this project.
So can I use the burnout word cliche? Did you have any burnout from these constant demands on you?
I think that's a fair thing to say. I mean, I was working at a wonderful organization, have amazing colleagues who have been doing this for a decade, and it's a real testament to their tenacity and sort of endurance. But for me, I did feel some burnout, and so I'm just taking this time off to recharge, and we'll see where it leads me next.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. I mean, I'm sure you guys have just been in such a struggle for so long, and it's so personal and professional, I guess.
Right.
One and the same time. And Aisha, what did you resign from?
So I'm a writer, an editor, and an international development consultant, and I was working at an interfaith environmental organization doing development work, which is fundraising. And
another burnout topic, I imagine.
Yeah, I've been doing that work for about 14 years. I love the human rights sector. I have a focus on women and girls, human rights, as well as marginalized and minority communities. And also very, very interested in storytelling. Writing is all about storytelling and connection and empathy and unexpected connections, I think, with people that we never knew we had that much in common with. So I think the book is sort of a natural outgrowth of those interests. And have just loved hearing from all of these amazing women. And I'm also a mom, so to a 2-year-old. So that also takes up a lot of my time.
Absolutely. I was just asking you off air whether he was a terrible twos or not, and you said he's quite spiritual.
He's my little whirling dervish.
And why not? So both of you have mentioned the word stories. And Noura, you talked about stories as being quite important in your work as an attorney.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Trying to tell different stories or reframe stories. What are some of the stories that have been important in the book, or in the making of the book, would you say? Either in terms of the stories that the women tell, or the story you were trying to tell more generally in producing.
Well, I think a couple of things. Like Noura mentioned, there's often only one frame through which American Muslims are seen, and an even narrower frame through which Muslim women are seen, which is all about oppression and subjugation and silence. And that really wasn't our personal experience, nor was it the experience that we saw the fabulous Muslim women friends that we have in our lives, who are extremely opinionated and funny and just fabulous. And we thought that we really wanted to hear more of those everyday stories. And we thought romantic stories or the search for love is something that everyone can get behind and relate to, because we're all looking for that in our own lives. And some of the stories are provocative, they're very fearless, they're cutting edge. One of the women is an Orthodox African-American woman who is dealing with her growing attraction to her female friend. And what happens within an Orthodox community when that happens? How does she deal with it? It's a really compelling story. Mm-hmm. There's also a great coming of age story in which a young Iranian American woman has the birds and bees talk from her mom in a very unusual and hilarious manner, which I think is going to resonate with all of us who went through that awkward conversation.
I just saw on the internet today an ABC TV interview with Madonna, mm-hmm. that is going out in full tonight or something.
Okay.
Where she's asked about numerous things, including her relationship with Lady Gaga, and uh-huh. whether she kisses women on the lips and with her tongue or only on the lips. But the best part is when she's asked about the birds and bees talks with her children.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, oh yes, well I've had that talk with my daughter. What about your son? Oh, he's too young, he doesn't need it.
That's funny.
Right.
So that's challenging even for Madonna. It's good to know.
So you're trying to, I guess, to show there's a multiplicity of plurality of stories that Muslim women have in relation to love, to romance, to sex.
Yeah. I think, you know, one thing I shouldn't always talk about, and I think it's been a frustration for the two of us growing up in this country and, you know, being professional women and having a lot of Muslim girlfriends, is that there's a lot that's been written about Muslim women, but very little of that has been written by Muslim women themselves. So you have all sorts of people opining on the lives of Muslim women and telling our stories, and this is what it's like to be a Muslim woman. And we thought it was time for us to tell our own stories and to sort of, you know, from our own experiences, put that forward and say, this is actually what it's like to be a Muslim woman, and it's not sort of the popular concept or what's out there right now. It's very different. And it's very different even within our community. So there's not one Muslim woman story. So there are issues of race and class and ethnic background and age, and all of these make up for very, very complex women and complex lives.
How did you recruit your authors?
We did a national call for stories that was word of mouth, through blogs, listservs, Facebook, Twitter, all of the sort of, you know, new social networking ways that we can connect with each other. So, and a lot of it was also through our personal connections, through people who knew us or knew of us through the work that we've done in the community. And so there was a certain level of trust that they were coming into the situation with. That's pretty phenomenal.
Sorry, what is that thing that's just come in front
red,
of you?
It's a gigantic red velvet donut.
But it looks like it's a little animal. Doesn't it? It's got sort of eyes and nose in the front.
I think this is an animal that even a vegetarian like you can get behind. We'll all have to try this. It's amazing.
I don't know. I'm quite intimidated. I'm worried that it'll jump up and bite us.
We'll just have to bite back.
So in other words, it was a combination of the traditional ways these things put together, contacts, and the newer ways, which are in a sense putting out calls for writing electronically. Now I noticed from seeing your fantastic website, what's the website called?
It's loveinshallah.com.
Loveinshallah.com. It's a sensational website, and you genuinely seem to update it daily. I mean, there are new things all the time. It looks great, it's really clean, to use the term, but it's also constantly being refreshed, which I really like. I gathered from looking at it and reading some information about authors that some have remained anonymous and some have not. I'd love to know about that, and I'd also like to know, in the context of the internet, you've just had a white English guy in Britain say that he is Wendy Deng, the Paradox Wife, on Twitter, and get away with it for some days. Do you know the authors of what they say they are?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so we actually, the two of us read, there was a fabulous anthology that came out about 8 years ago.
2005,
called Bitch in the House. And it was a New York Times bestseller, and it was a collection of 26 stories written by American non-Muslim women about marriage, motherhood, work, and
sex.
And several of the authors in that anthology chose to write under pen names because they were, you know, there were
same reasons
that our writers were dealing with, some privacy issues, trying to sort of respect current partners that they're with, the privacy of current partners they're with, family, sensitive family issues, so a variety of reasons. So we made that available to some of our writers, and of the 25, we only have 5 that are writing under pen names. So
that's one thing that a lot of our advanced readers have actually remarked upon, is the sort of fearlessness under which these women have written about really intimate parts of their lives.
Yes.
And for the most part, that's my fault. Thank you.
Where was your dress? Did you guys need silverware?
Yes.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Wow, this looks great. So, they've really remarked upon the fact that these women have gone into such great detail about these very vulnerable and intimate portions of their lives. And we do know who the writers are, because they've also had to sign legal disclosures and that type of thing with us.
My sense is also that... Thank you very much. This is an era when more and more people are writing pseudonymously. In the internet era, so many people have imaginary tags, as if the graffiti artist were the model of authorship, right? Such that the conventions of always using your own given names, that convention is not necessarily dying out, but it's threatened by the notion of having an online identity or a novelistic identity or whatever it might be, for whatever reasons. But it's actually a fashion, I think, as well as a question of respect or security or privacy that we see.
In the Egyptian revolution recently, we saw that many of the organizers chose to remain anonymous for security reasons, and I think that it allowed for this flourishing for the Arab Spring to happen, you know, to have that sort of privacy there. But I think that we're also pushing, it's directly also related for us, back to a more sort of compassionate and respectful discourse within the community, within all of the communities in the U.S., whether it's the American Muslim community or people who are not Muslim but who are American neighbors, that, you know, some of these, you can write anonymously, but you can also write respectfully. I mean, one of the things that the internet also sort of does is bring out the trolls, they're under this anonymous sort of cloak, and they feel that they can say things that they wouldn't necessarily say to anyone to their face. But we can still use some of those anonymous identities, but still engage in civil discourse as well. I think that's a possibility.
Yeah. In terms of issues in the community, to use the expression, the Muslim community that you guys have deployed today, what are some of the things that confront Muslim women and that make their lives rich? What are the things that they are finding to be problematic? What are the things that they're finding to be enriching in the area of love, romance, sex, intimacy?
Well, I think a lot of the issues, actually, one thing that really jumped out at me as you read the book is that a lot of the issues that the Muslim women in our book are facing are similar to issues that all women are facing in love. So finding a suitable partner to bring home to your parents, issues of family, dealing with family expectations, whether that be professional expectations, you know, socioeconomic status of your partner, racism. There's just a whole host of topics that our writers really delve into. And what's interesting is that, so those issues are relatable for Muslims and non-Muslims. And then
they're shared, really, aren't they?
Shared, right, right. And, you know, I was just remarking to a friend of mine the other day that, you know, I'm 33, I recently got engaged. But
congratulations,
thank you.
I can see the rock.
It's blinding.
But, you know, I just got engaged and, you know, I've been seeing somebody for the last year, but until then I was a woman in my 30s who was single, an attorney, and, you know, a lot of my girlfriends from college, from law school, who are not Muslim, were similarly single, and the question is always, like, well, when are you going to get married? And so that's not just a Muslim issue, it's sort of an issue that's shared across backgrounds for everyone. So, so that's something that really jumped out at us in the book. But then on top of that, the women in the book are sort of really dealing with some issues that are specific to the Muslim community, religious expectations, religious values sort of imposed from family or themselves, sort of negotiating. Immigrant experiences for some of the writers, for other of the writers who maybe have converted to Islam, sort of cultural and religious tensions between themselves and their non-Muslim families. So there are some of these topics that are really specific to the Muslim community.
Right. What about the richness of Islam as a background for love? In terms of its literature, its art, its teachings, and so on.
We were just talking about this on the way over, actually, about how we're so lucky as Western Muslims to have this very rich sort of Western tradition of Romeo and Juliet and all these wonderful stories, but also from the Islamic tradition, Layla Majnun, and very traditional stories about, you know, very passionate love. And that we felt that this is sort of our contribution to that type of literature. You know, that our lives in some ways reflect that great tradition of these love stories, but also have a new and contemporary sort of twist as people meet on the internet, as divorce rates have risen and people are negotiating those type of new relationships. They may be negotiating stepchildren as they, you know, move forward with a relationship. A lot of them are also talking about physical relationships. How do you negotiate, like, how far do you actually want to go? And the women in the stories have very, very different perspectives on that. And I just feel like there's a lot of them are extremely romantic stories, and they're all very individual stories. There's 25 stories in the anthology, and they're all just very different from each other, and they really run the range of and add that sort of very romantic texture in very different ways.
And are they grouped in any sense by genre?
Yeah, we have four sections. Four sections. Mm-hmm. So one of the sections are stories where women, it's called In Search of the Beloved. So women talking about sort of either a spiritual journey or a journey just to find something greater than themselves and in the process find love. We have a section called Love Overseas, where women are talking about men abroad, international men of mystery that they meet abroad. We have a section on
which is the really American story.
Yeah,
the girl who goes overseas to find herself in true love.
We have a section called Love Online, where women talk about meeting partners through sort of the new ways in which people sort of connect online.
Cyber love.
We have a section called It All Starts at the Beginning, where writers talk about firsts. So first in terms of courtship and sex and dating and the birds and the bees stories in that section. And we have one more section, actually. It's called Third Time's the Charm. So third time's the Naseeb. Naseeb in Arabic means destiny. And it's where women find love the third time around.
so loving after loss.
It sounds quite a hopeful book.
Oh, definitely. It's very hopeful. That's actually something that also a lot of our advanced readers commented on. About one of them said to me, I wish that I had had this book when I was growing up Muslim in America, because I feel such a community and I feel like they're so hopeful and these are such rich and creative and beautiful lives, and I didn't have that in her own community, specific personal community. She didn't feel that reflected. So it was her being able to connect to a community of sisters across the U.S. basically who felt similarly to her.
Can I ask you a broader historical question now, and we can go back towards the book at any time you want. Have you experienced a watershed that would periodize 2001 before and after as a moment of radical change in the experience of being a Muslim woman in the United States?
I can speak to that.
I mean, you mentioned earlier that your NGO, or sorry, civil rights group that mm-hmm. you were working for was about 10 years old, so
right.
I'm assuming it's in some sense.
Well, that organization, it did form in the wake of 9/11 and some of the civil rights and national security challenges that were really facing the American Muslim community. And I think, you know, it's hard to say that 9/11 was this, I mean, I do think it was this huge event and sort of awakening for a lot of segments of the American Muslim community. I think, you know, even from myself personally, growing up, people just didn't know anything about Islam. I remember telling a girl in high school that I was Muslim, and that evening my brother said, "Hey, why did you tell Kim you're Mormon?" And I just remember thinking it was so funny that she had never even heard of Muslims, so she thought I was Mormon, that I had just sort of misspoken, and that I didn't, in fact, know what I was. And so I think there was just a lot of ignorance about Islam, but ignorance from a place of real sort of lack of knowledge and lack of exposure. And I think after 9/11, there's just a lot more familiarity with Islam and sort of these images that have been played through the media and other avenues where people are now, a lot of people are really misinformed about Islam. And so I think for that, for me personally, it's been sort of coming to recognize that and recognize my own power in changing some of those misconceptions, just sort of as an individual in the way that I lead my life. And sometimes a real responsibility, and I know that a lot of people feel, a lot of American Muslims feel that sort of weight of responsibility too, that we as American Muslims have a responsibility to sort of portray the real essence of Islam, which has been really grossly misunderstood.
But also an opportunity for us to show the real diversity, I think. Because in the post 9/11 narrative about Muslims, it's either violent or extremely orthodox who are usually the ones who are highlighted within the mainstream media, at least. And so these are not representative, I think, of necessarily the entire spectrum of American Muslims. And we really made a point to make sure that cultural, secular, and Orthodox Muslims were included in this book, because that is the true diversity of our community. There's a very broad spectrum of practice, there's a broad spectrum of ethnic and racial backgrounds. African Americans, for example, make up the majority of American Muslims, and yet are very rarely included in articles that might be focused on the community. So we really wanted to make a point to show that there's a lot more diversity and many more stories and are actually getting out there.
I think I'm right in saying that in the federal Congress, there's only one Muslim congressman.
Two.
So
yeah.
Keith Ellison
and Andre Carson.
Andre Carson.
From Indiana.
Is he new?
He was elected, I think, a year or two after Ellison. Keith Ellison, yeah.
And is he also African American?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because I remember when Ellison wanted to take the oath of allegiance on the Quran, there was a major fight
right.
in the Congress.
Right.
On Thomas Jefferson's Quran, copy of the Quran.
It's a huge issue. Around that time, he got a fair bit of media coverage to talk. He was a very smart guy, it seems to me. I don't know much about his politics, but he's very impressive in discussing these issues. But I don't think there's anybody in the Senate, and there aren't that many people in the state Congress on there. I think the upper Midwest, there are some South Asians. People are not sure that they're Muslim.
Yeah, there's a couple members, Arab American members of Congress, but I don't. But they're not Muslim.
They're not Muslim. Yeah, I mean, because when you think about these things, one of the issues is visibility. Mm-hmm. Inevitably, focus on is politics. Another is CEOs. Another is museums. Another is television programs. I mean, these areas where marginalized groups find themselves not reflected. Where you see supposedly representative entities failing, in a sense, to give us any kind of rich demographic picture of our country.
And I think that that's sort of really another motivation for our book. You know, we, as Aisha said, we grew up, you know, reading Jane Austen and, Sweet Valley High, all these sort of popular romance novels, and watching romantic comedies. I'm a sucker for romantic comedies. I've seen them all.
Thank you very much.
And then there comes a point in your life where you want to see yourself and the women that you know reflected in those movies or in those books. And so this was sort of our way of showing, like, look, we, you know, we're similar and we sort of have these stories as well. As I dig into my red velvet donut,
you need some cream in that.
Yeah.
But I think it's a very good question, because I think another trend that we're seeing is coming of age of American Muslim writers. Just take the last 2 years and the releases that are happening this year with anthologies, novels, memoirs written by American Muslim writers. It's like we're at the crest of this, you know, literary explosion, basically. And I think in some ways 9/11 was a turning point. You know, many of us were really young at that time. It was a defining moment, not only for our country, but our community, for us as Americans and as Muslims as well. And for us, for those of us who came from an immigrant background, with my parents immigrated in the late 60s, and like many first generation immigrants, they sort of talk about back home as opposed to here. And I think that's very common, whether you talk about Japanese Americans or German Americans or Italian Americans, the first generation sort of still looks back to another country as also their home. But this enabled us to really, as second generation, feel that this is our country and we want to contribute our stories and we want to talk about our experiences, and they're just as valid as any other immigrants to this nation. And I think, again, going back to the African-American community, it's a little different in that community because, of course, they've been here for centuries, mm-hmm. and they don't have that sort of vacillation between what is home.
Right.
But I think that it was a watershed, as you're saying, that it enabled us to really come to terms with the fact that, yes, we're Americans, yes, we're Muslims, we belong here, we are going to be here, and this is what we have to say.
Interesting. And where did your parents come from?
Pakistan.
So they came before the split.
Yes, that
East
happened shortly after they...
Well, I'm going to use that.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
I think they've not yet begun to fight with that critter, whatever it is.
I think you need to try that as well.
I'm very intimidated.
I think you're tempted.
I'm tempted, but slightly intimidated. Frightened.
Please.
If there were a way I could get a tiny smidgen.
Please, yes.
Nowhere near the tail or the mouth.
Have a little bit more. It's quite delicious.
It's the color, I think.
Yeah.
The red.
Oh my god, that's good. This expression, I don't know if it's a US expression, but in British English, Moorish.
Wow.
It doesn't mean as in the Moor. Mm. It means Moorish, like I want some
more.
Oh. M-O-R-E-I-S-H. It's fantastic. Ruling class expression from the 1930s. But very Moorish.
Mm. Please, sir, may I have some more?
Yeah, it's good. Yes, the other side of Dickens. In terms of the African-American community, one of the things I noticed that I find quite different from from the debates that go on about Islam in Europe as opposed to here. So in Europe, in many cases, however erroneously, this is thought of as an immigrant issue. Here, it gets portrayed as if it were an immigrant issue in the media, even though the material reality is quite other. And African Americans as Muslims seem to me to be silenced almost. Is that your sense or no?
And I think there's been, you know, and I think that that's something that's been sort of the diversity of the American Muslim community has really in some ways sort of, when I was speaking earlier about the politicization of the Muslim community, I think that sort of ethnic diversity in the American Muslim community in some ways has really been exploited by policymakers. I think, you know, a lot of the policies that have come down that specifically target the American Muslim community have really focused on the immigrant Muslim community and tangentially have touched the African American Muslim community as well. But I think it's, I always thought that that was sort of an interesting way in which our community is even portrayed, you know, as a very immigrant Muslim community. But, you know, one thing that a lot of people may not know is that I think it was about a quarter to a third of the slaves that were brought back during the slave trade were actually Muslim. So Islam has been a real part of this country from its very, very beginning. And as Aisha mentioned about, you know, African Americans are the largest group of Muslims. And Islam has really, you know, besides the sort of history of Muslim slaves in this country, even in the 60s, there was, you know, this real rebirth of Islam in the African American Muslim community. With the Nation of Islam and then the Wahhabi Muhammad Muslim community. In fact, my fiancé is African American and he's third generation Muslim. His grandparents converted to Islam in the 60s and his mother's Muslim, he was born Muslim. So I think we're seeing, you know, and in our book as well, we have several African American writers, a couple of whom have converted, a couple of whom were born Muslim. So there's even diversity in that experience as well.
Yeah, but I think there's room for more inclusivity, and I think that's one of the hopes for our book is that we ourselves, that's from being within the faith community, hopefully will start thinking in a bigger way about who is part of that community, that secular folk are part of that community, that Orthodox folk, that cultural Muslims are part of that, that the different ethnicities and religions, different sexualities, sexual orientations are part of that, to really try and create a much bigger umbrella, to try and create more compassionate interactions between us, to stop all of the talk about who's a real Muslim and who's not a real Muslim, which happens within the community and it happens outside of the community as well, as we saw recently with this fringe Florida group that sort of attacked the TLC show All American Muslim.
Thank you.
I've just been given a license to take over the table. This lady is one of the owners. She's my informant about the DEA. Okay. So you talk about the DEA. I guess that's what she's looking. Thank you very much. So we can now get this computer slightly.
Yeah, I know. I don't want it to.
And the bubble up as well. I was going to ask you about LGBT issues. I should say that the list, there are not going to be as many people listening to this as there will be watching you on Voice of America, or probably any of the other interviews you do. But in any given week, there are people in 50 countries who listen to the podcast. So some of the terms that we use in the United States in everyday ways, particularly people who are not first language English users, are quite mysterious. So I'm saying that to myself as much as to you guys. So I should say lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, those groups. Mm-hmm. How is their situation, would you say, in American Islam compared to US life more generally in terms of, you know, the Protestant domination, Catholic domination, in terms of the Jewish world? The issues that those folks face, are they qualitatively different or would you say they're very similar?
Great question. You know, I think it really depends on which American Muslim community you're talking about. There is a more Orthodox community which is only beginning to have some of the conversations around gay Muslims and what role they can or should play within the community, and whether or not they should be, for example, welcomed into the mosque and other things like that. And then there are progressive Muslims. Muslims for Progressive Values is one organization that comes to mind that states very clearly in its founding document that gay Muslims are absolutely a part of their community. So I think there's a whole range of discussions that appear to be happening, which I think is very similar to the Jewish experience in America, which has Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform, and Reconstructionist sort of attitudes towards many of the issues around gender and sexuality.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we speak a lot in this country of cultural Judaism. Mm. It's something that you hear about a lot. One doesn't hear as much discussion of cultural Islam. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I think there's been an understanding of it as... they're called like the Eid Muslims, I've heard. You know, like they may come, the only time you might see them at mosque is like on Eid, just like you might see certain Christians at church on Christmas. So they're very much still tied to the community and their identity as Muslims, but it may not be in more Orthodox forms of daily worship and practice. But I believe it is a fairly new concept, and I think a lot of Muslims are still grappling with the idea of, can you be a fully secular Muslim? Can you be an atheist Muslim? What does that really mean?
Yeah. And I think a lot of this, there's a lot of fear in the community, and I think, some of the issues that we're dealing with are sensitive because it is a community that a lot of American Muslims feel is under siege. Sort of politically,
I think that's yours.
Oh, that yours?
Yours. No, it's the chamomile. Is that yours?
No, I wasn't chamomile.
Oh, I wasn't either.
No one was chamomile.
No.
Maybe we should
the mysterious fourth guest. Okay, let's just put the mysterious fourth guest tea next to the empty bubble up, and we'll see what those guys come up with.
I was just saying that I think there is a lot of fear within the community as a community that sort of sees itself, people seeing themselves under siege, in the way in which sort of government policies have really been targeting the community. And so I think because of that, maybe it's sort of slowed down some of the conversations that would have happened otherwise, because the community is just dealing with a lot of competing issues and interests and more defensive posturing. But we are starting to see, especially in this particular dealing with homosexual lesbians, that it's an issue that people are starting to talk about much more openly now.
I mean, my sense is that's happening across the country more generally. When you look at opinion polls, there's really quite a radical change in the last decade over attitudes to these issues across different groups.
Especially in the under 30s.
Yes, it's an age thing. A lot of it is an age thing. Yeah. Very clearly. Pardon me. A little bit of leftover grunge from Mexico City asthma. I wanted to ask if I could, both of you, about the law in all of this. L-A-W, L-O-R-E, and the difference between religious forms of law and secular forms of law, which of course are very interpenetrated in the United States as everywhere else, despite the Constitution, as we know. And how L-A-W and L-O-R-E connect to Muslim love?
That's an interesting question. So, I'll take the L-O-R-E, since we have an attorney sitting right here. I think sort of what I referenced earlier about there being a really rich lore, as far as poetry, stories, even stories about lesbians and gays as being a part of the sort of Muslim cultural history. In Pakistan, for example, where my parents are from, there are very openly homosexual songs and love songs that are part of the culture. The difference, I think, is in America there's a very specific idea of what does it mean to be gay, and in a way that I think has become perhaps a separation from what it might have traditionally been thought of in Pakistan or the Middle East or other places of Muslim, where Muslims live. that's a little new, I think, post-60s. And I think the Muslim community, like Nora said, is sort of dealing with that. But on the other hand, I just feel like if you look at the poetry, you look at the songs, you look at the culture, all of those traces of romantic love, whether it's heterosexual or homosexual, are within our history and within our community. They're just being brought out in a somewhat different way. And then as far as law goes, I'll hand this over to you.
Yeah, I think for law, you know, what we've seen in the last several years, we've seen this with the abortion issue, we've seen this with gay marriage, and I think now we're seeing it with Muslims and these Sharia initiatives, is that certain communities are often used as political wedge issues. So when something, you know, a couple years back when it was, you know, trying to rally a conservative base to the polls, it was all about banning gay marriage and that being sort of used as a mobilization tactic. And we've seen that in this coming election. I think we're going to see it a lot more. We saw it in the last election. I think we're going to see it a lot more in the coming election, these anti-Sharia initiatives that are sort of really proliferating all over the country in various state ballot measures is a real sort of galvanizing tool to bring people to the polls. And I think that that's sort of playing on what we were talking about before, that fear of the unknown, fear of the other, and sort of exploiting that fear for political gain. And so, you know, it was, you know, the gay and lesbian community really has been the victim of that. I think the Muslim community now is experiencing that.
Right.
I'm sure, unfortunately, it'll be some other group that sort of bears the brunt of that going forward.
Well, I think definitely in Western Europe, fear of Sharia law and various caricatures thereof is absolutely central to the ethos of the place. I wanted to ask you another question related to that, which is that in terms of these ballot initiatives and also justifications for foreign policy.
Can I have another one too, please?
It seems to me that women's bodies are often alibis for these things. So a lot of the justification for the invasion of Afghanistan and even somewhat in Iraq was to liberate Islamic women from the horrors of the state and give them a brand of U.S. government-endorsed Western female liberation. This is very similar to what the British claimed as a justification for their empire over centuries. It's a standard enlightenment argument about the value of imperialism and colonialism, that women must be freed from the depredations of backward male civilization and dominance. Right? That seems to be a theme that's recurring, and you're saying it's actually probably going to be implicitly or explicitly a big one again in 2012 in our national election.
Right. You want a black tea?
She just thinks she's convinced that someone, it's
someone
the fourth
wants
person who wants
caffeine.
She thinks we shouldn't have any more caffeine.
Yeah, that's it. Anyway, I just wondered about your perspective on that, because you were talking earlier about government policies and their relevance to a lot of this.
And that's sort of what we were getting at with the whole purpose of this book, is that so many people claim to speak on behalf of Muslim women, but there's rarely a step back to say, well, what do Muslim women want? What do Muslim women think? Because our stories are not getting out. And so, you know, that kind of reminds me of the French ban on the niqab, the face veil, and how, you know, it was really pushed forward as this law that was going to liberate French Muslim women who were being forced to cover. And yet again, it was sort of the state or someone telling Muslim women what was in their best interest instead of the other way around, having it maybe be a groundswell movement from Muslim women themselves. And that was sort of why, you know, why these things are very much, very, in a lot of ways, are quite offensive to Muslim women. You know, as being Muslim women, it's frustrating to hear somebody say, we're going to do X, Y, and Z to help you,
when
we'd like them to say, how would you like to be helped? What are your stories? Can we listen to what you actually need? And having come from an international development perspective for the last 14 years, there are different ways of doing development, and there's a very top-down way and there's a very grassroots way, and the way that attracts me is to actually sit down with communities and begin where they are and begin to understand what their needs are and start working on that.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because development changed a lot of its ethos over the last 50 years to focus much more on women, on the grounds that, and again, gets to the regulation of women's sexuality, that birth rates are part of the problem, and that therefore female literacy is part of the cure, because female literacy leads to more contraception. I mean, these sorts of folk. But it's still with an understanding that things have to be done to women to make their lives better. Is that right?
Yeah, and I don't think that women's liberation comes by raining bombs down on them. You know, it's simply you are destroying their infrastructure and their families, and women and girls end up bearing the burden far more of war as well, living on as widows, living on with maimed children or dead children, and decimating a society's infrastructure doesn't really help with women's liberation. So Afghanistan and Iraq and other places that have been invaded could definitely have been dealt with in different ways. Once you're on the ground and you're there, I think the development needs to take on a very different cast. You can't say we're just going to impose Western feminism or liberation or anything else on someone. I think it's really important to engage communities and just talk to them and to listen. I think listening is really a forgotten value in today's day and age.
Well, asking about listening, what was it like when you sat down and shared your views as editors about what you were going to include in the book and what you weren't? I mean, when you had to deal with the, I presume, inevitable moments when one person likes a story, the other one's not so sure. One person thinks the style's no good, but the story's great, and vice versa. Right. What was it like editing as a process?
Well, Noura's an attorney, so she always wins arguments.
Push, push, push until you win.
It was actually a real growing process for both of us and a learning process. Where we started 5 years ago from the original call, and then we issued another call last year. Both of those calls are in substance very similar, but we also incorporated our learnings in the sense of realizing that we needed to do very specific outreach to different communities, we needed to address different concerns, we needed to actually say, you are welcome if you're secular, you are welcome if you're a cultural Muslim, you are welcome if you're a lesbian Muslim woman, you know, and to really, or even African Americans or Arab Americans, we did specific calls to each of those communities.
You couldn't assume people would simply answer a generic call.
Yes.
They need to be told,
absolutely,
we really want
you. Yes, right. Absolutely.
Right.
And that you will be, your context, your perspective, and your story will be respected.
Right.
I think that's also been a huge issue, is that whether it's through the mainstream media or other places, when Muslim women do share their stories, they sometimes feel that things are taken out of context or they're twisted for other agendas. And this was, you know, we were saying, we not only respect you, but you get to take the mic.
Right.
And you get to tell your own story.
And that our job as editors is to help amplify these voices, not to control their narrative. And we made that very clear to the writers from the very beginning, that the story would not go to print unless it had
their
full approval. And we wanted them to be comfortable with the final product.
It's very much a partnership. And it's definitely, I mean, it's been a huge part of our relationship. I mean, we've been working on this book almost the entire time that we've known each other. So we've known each other 6 years, and we've been working on the book for 5 years.
Right.
And it's kind of like a marriage,
yeah.
And you learn how to communicate with each other and to get your way.
It's been a very happy marriage.
What was the conversation that led you to decide this was needed?
We were just sitting in a cafe one day, and I was saying, did you see that article about another ISNA matchmaking dinner? And, you know, I'm so tired of seeing matchmaking and arranged marriages as being the only story that's told about Muslim women and how they find true love, because that's not how I found it. That ended up not being how she found it either. And
I was saying that I had just come back from watching a terrible romantic comedy. But as I was watching the terrible romantic comedy, I thought to myself, most of my Muslim girlfriends have gone through an experience like this? And what would the sort of Muslim twist on this movie be? So we sort of started chatting, and we thought, well, why not reach out? Why not
so ask this them? Is the Muslim rom-com. Yes. Or the is rom-com.
Islam rom-com, yes. Yeah, and so we thought, you know, we know our friends and our sisters and our, you know, the women that we know have these very vibrant love lives, and people meet each other in a variety of ways, and why not try to collect those stories and tell them.
Now this is where I have to ask you about your obsessions with Jon Stewart.
He's fabulous.
As the, you know,
Jon, if you're listening, we love you.
Earl Grey, right?
Earl Grey?
Yes. Anything black. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Yes, because I read, was it Huffington Post?
Yes.
Yes. A story about
why Muslim women are crushing
Jon Stewart. Women are sexually obsessed. Romantically obsessed with Jon Stewart. Oh my god.
Choices.
I think I'll go with English breakfast. Thank you very much. I mean, I'd love to know how I get to be Jon Stewart, but in general terms, but I was fascinated by this, and if you could tell us a bit more, it would be interesting.
He's funny, and he's good looking.
He's smart.
Okay, well, those are three good qualifications.
And on top of all of that, you know, I think in this 24-hour news cycle, the sensational stories always get the news, and the crazy fringe groups always get in the news because by virtue of being a crazy fringe group, you're interesting. And
you become much bigger. And you become magnifying.
You become much bigger, your message is amplified, and everybody hears your agenda. And in that news cycle, there's just sort of a lot, as we were talking before, of, you know, Muslims being part of this, part of the political calculus and being used as a wedge issue. And for us, what we love about Jon Stewart and the Colbert Report as well is that Jon Stewart cuts out all the BS. You know, he tells the truth. It's like the same voice in this symphony of crazy voices.
I think symphony is a very, very polite word to use.
Cacophony, maybe.
Yeah, so he just, you know, when we, it's just refreshing to be able to turn on the TV and just
and hear, not cringe.
Not cringe, and hear somebody call it like it is. And it's not, you know, on issues that affect the Muslim community and issues generally. This, you know, we live in crazy political times, and he just breaks it down every evening for his viewers.
But so Riz Khan just doesn't do it for you, is that right?
No, we don't want to start a little war here. Riz Khan is great.
He has a little signature.
It's also with humor, and he does it, you know, he's hilarious. And, you know, it's fun to watch.
Girls love fun boys, because boys never stop looking as girls, so they have something they offer. But
someone commented on our Huffington Post article saying he embodies the grand Jewish tradition of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. And I thought that was just beautiful and on point, and that it is a grand tradition, you know, and that it's something that we relate to, and using that humor to really cut down these people to size, whether it's a politician or a fringe group or some other crazy person. And just having a good time while doing it, but really speaking truth to power, protecting minorities and marginalized communities, and having fun. Yeah. So it's something that we really respond to, and every time there's some big issue going on about American Muslims, we see, you know, our Facebook light up with all our girlfriends saying, I love John, John's the best, and having links to his, you know, whatever that day's drama has been that he's put into perspective for everyone.
And one of the things I think you said in your piece was that you like the idea of this slightly shocking your Muslim lovers, but also that they might kind of fancy him deep down as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that we can watch with our moms and give each other that sidelong understanding glance.
And is Dad in the room at this point?
No,
Dad, my dad loves Jon Stewart.
Mine
too. Actually, a lot of our male friends said, hey, Muslim men love Jon Stewart too.
We've got about 5 minutes left, and what I wanted to ask you about, if I could now, was promoting the book. I mentioned this fantastic website, that you're constantly updating. And you guys have said...
I just realized I need to feed my meter.
Oh, I haven't got any coins.
I'll be right back.
All right.
Yeah.
Both mentioned that you've now dedicated your professional lives to this. So I wanted to ask about how you're pushing it. And the backdrop to that is in the old days, a potentially major trade talk like this would have a full-time publicist dedicated to it who would organize and pay for your trips around the country.
Right. So we are using the magic and the power of the internet to organize a book tour. It's a 5-city book tour. We're starting off in San Francisco on February 3rd, and we'll be leaving for, and we have a number, and these are all on our website, loveinshallah.com. All of our events are listed there. We have a number of readings, bookstore events, a launch party. Then we'll be flying to Boston, arriving on the 12th. We'll be spending a couple of days there. We're speaking at Harvard and Boston universities. We're also going down to New York City on February 15th, where we have Blue Stocking and some other bookstores, and perhaps NYU or Columbia as well, interested in doing events with us. And then we'll be in Washington, D.C., where we have some great house parties and bookstore events too, hopefully busboys and poets among them. And we'll also be doing some events here in Los Angeles at the end of February. So. That's been our major push. Again, we're using word of mouth, our friends, networks, Facebook and Twitter to really get the word out. We've had amazing responses so far from people who want to bring us to their cities. We're hoping that in the fall we'll be able to do a Midwest tour as well, get the middle of the country. So that's where we're starting out, in those 5 cities. But we hope that this will be an ongoing sort of thing. We may be developing workshops for mosques and Muslim students associations around relationships. So we're looking at a number of different aspects of how to promote the book. We also have some media interest as well, especially around Valentine's Day. So I expect that we'll see the book in feature articles and radio shows around Valentine's.
The last time I was in India, where I lived when I was a child, was the first year that Valentine's Day was being massively celebrated. And there were huge protests against this, which, as far as I could see, were actually about card commodification by the United States. They were about cultural imperialism, as much as anything else. I think that's a wonderful idea to be doing something special for Valentine's Day.
Yeah, I think it's going to be fun. We're going to have a really good time. We have wonderful friends and organizations in each of those cities who are ready to party, ready to engage.
That's fantastic. And who's publishing the book?
Soft Skull Press in
Soft
Berkeley.
Soft Skull Press in Berkeley. I'm not familiar with that. Can you tell
it's
us a bit
about it?
It's
a small, independent, cutting-edge publisher.
Wonderful publisher. Yeah. Really, we're so honored to be published by them. They were just wonderfully supportive through the entire process, really respected our intention and our vision for the book.
Content to the cover,
right,
which is contentious for a lot of writers, especially unknown writers, and especially writers of color. It can be a real issue. They really, really respected us and partnered with us every step of the way. They're amazing.
Fantastic. Well, you do know that this will be a success, and then a big trade house will come after you to do the one that they think they can distribute better.
Well, from your lips to God's ears.
When does the book become available in digital stores?
So January 24th is the release date for the print copy, and February 1st for the e-copy, and then March 1st for the United Kingdom. And we hope that it's going to continue to become available in many other countries, and hopefully translated as well.
So I was going to ask you about translation rights and possibilities, because it seems as though it would potentially have readers, you know, from all over the world, really.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we're our marketing team at the publisher is still working on that, and we'll be getting updates and posting them as new editions are becoming available. And beyond translations, we'd love to take this to different countries eventually. That's one of our visions, is to have a Love Inshallah Britain, a Love Inshallah India, where women from that community are telling their own stories, because we don't want to presume that they're the same stories as American Muslims.
Wonderful. Well, I want to thank both of you very much for joining us in the pod today and telling us about your own lives. You've been very generous and open about those, and also about the book, and try to exact a promise from you that maybe at the end of the book tour, if I can find a way either to see both of you or one of you, to find out about how your travels went and the things you learned when you were on them. We could do another podcast.
Would love that.
Wonderful. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us. Yeah, this has been really such a fun pleasure.